Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are ready to hear the first case for this morning, Rochelle Waste against the National Labor Relations Board.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Josh Vinson on behalf of the petitioner, Rochelle Waste. I want to go straight to the Loperex decision that the Court decided December 31st because I think that creates a new issue in this case that didn't exist previously, and that is the specific finding by the Court that there is a distinction between discipline and corrective action. And I think that that's significant, that the Court said that the Board must be careful to distinguish between those two to make sure that each part has meaning. And when you go directly to the Regional Director's decision in this case, that distinction was not made. In fact, if you look at the Regional Director's decision, he conflated the two, corrective action and discipline, in precisely the manner that the Court in Loperex said that the Board should not and cannot. And specifically, I direct the Court's attention to pages A47 and A53 of our appendix, because that is where the Regional Director's decision starts off in dealing with the question of responsible direction and accountability, and talks specifically about discipline and corrective action as if they are one and the same. So we have an extraordinary circumstance, I think, within the meaning of Section 10E. There's been an intervening decision by this Court that announces a new rule of law that the Board has failed to apply. And so I think, for that reason, it needs to be addressed.
Loperex says that the ability to take corrective action is, in fact, not necessarily the same thing as discipline. But I'm not sure that the negative inference that you're reading into Loperex, which is that the Board was without discretion to think that these are related, is necessarily the case.
Well, related is one thing, but conflating and treating them as identical is different. And in this case, the Court said you've got to distinguish between the two. And in this instance, the Regional Director treated them as if they were exactly interchangeable, discipline and corrective action. And if that distinction had been made in this case, it would make a difference under the evidence.
Why would it make a difference? I mean, I don't see where you introduced evidence that focused on that.
Well, there is evidence of corrective action here. Where the Regional Director bounced us on this issue was that there wasn't enough evidence of discipline. But there was evidence of corrective action, and specifically I'd point you to pages R62 of the record, keeping employees late to finish work, which is almost the exact example the Court gave in Loperex, pages R24, R68, and R142 and 3, counseling employees, corrective counseling, that the employees should keep a compactor machine running in order to continue to compact the garbage. Page R42 of the record, adjusting time cards to correct problems with how the employees were punching in, if they weren't there on time or not. So I think there is a significant new issue that has arisen.
So there's another aspect of the Board's test, too, though, which is personal accountability. So in order to be a supervisor, you have to be personally accountable for the performance of those people who report to you.
Well, Judge, that's the other issue that I don't think Loperex really addresses, and I do think the Court needs to address. And that is the point that when the Board decided Oakwood Healthcare and addressed the question of what does it mean to be responsible, it adopted the definition of the Board's previous decision in Providence Hospital, which said being responsible meant simply that you had a duty or obligation to perform. It did not say that you are responsible only if you are held accountable for someone else's mistake.
But
you're responsible for your own errors. If you fail to direct employees to perform their tasks, then that's responsible. You're accountable for your failure to properly direct the employees. If you direct the employees properly, as the employer has required you to do, and the employees don't perform their tasks as they are supposed to do, responsible doesn't mean that you are on almost an agency basis being held vicariously liable
for the
employee's defalcation or misfeasance.
No, I mean, I understand what you're arguing, but it seems to me odd to think that the Board is not entitled to use, in a sense, the buck stops here sort of rule, you know, that if the employees are not performing, just as if you have people in your law office, associates or somebody who's working for you, you're responsible in the end. If they don't do a good job, you're responsible.
A good example would be under the Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission. As a supervisor, I have a responsibility to supervise. If I tell my associate, don't file this brief because it contains an incorrect cite, and the associate goes ahead and files it anyway, my responsibility ethically was, did I discharge my duty as a supervisor? I told the associate not to do that.
But if your signature is on the brief, it doesn't matter whether the associate followed your direction or not. You're responsible.
Vis-a-vis the court, certainly. But vis-a-vis for ethical violations, I think it would be a different rule because as a supervisor, I've discharged my obligation ethically, and now the associate doesn't have the safe harbor of having been properly supervised
Listen to what you're saying. It seems to me we're drawing some fine distinctions here, and our job is to decide whether the board has interpreted these rules in a way that's permissible under the labor statute.
I agree 100%, and if you look at the Supreme Court's decision in Kentucky River, that's exactly the point that the court makes there, is that when the court makes the point that the board, certainly you can do some Chevron line drawing, as you pointed out in Loprex, but nonetheless, when we start to get into this effort to sort of gerrymander the definitions to manage who is and who isn't falling within the scope of the bargaining unit, which is effectively what they're doing, and it's not true to the statutory language, that's where the court steps in. And that's precisely our point here, is that it is not true to the statutory language. Just as in Kentucky River, where you had a situation where they were talking about a distinction between the kind of independent judgment and the degree of independent judgment that was being exercised, is exactly what the Supreme Court called the board out on. And that's what I think needs to be done here.
Although, of course, in Kentucky River, it was another one of these nurse cases. It seems to me one of the other important things about Kentucky River is the finding that the burden of proof is on the party who's asserting supervisory status, which means, in this case, on you.
Absolutely. And I feel we carry that burden. Okay. I do want to address also this issue about the termination of Jeff Jarvis and whether it was pretextual or not. That's a very onerous standard of review. There's no question about that. But one of the things I want to point out about the court's prior decisions as to the standard of review on this point is that if you look at cases like Weiss Memorial, Sears, Vulcan, Slusher, every one of those cases demonstrates that there's a difference between an ALJ who draws conclusions from conflicting evidence and an ALJ who ignores evidence. Because if the ALJ, it's one thing. I mean, if you draw conclusions from conflicting evidence, that's fine. I'm stuck on the standard of review. But if the ALJ has ignored evidence, then by definition there cannot be substantial evidence to support the decision, because by ignoring evidence, the ALJ hasn't considered all of the evidence and drawn conclusions from the conflict. And in this case, that's the precise problem here, is that there was significant evidence that was ignored on crucial issues dealing with the pretext point. And I just want to give you three quick examples here. One is the ALJ said there was uncontradicted evidence that Jeff Jarvis was never warned about this cover violation issue, that they needed to do a better job of covering the garbage at the end of the workday. Well, you know, if you look at the record, you see at pages U75, U174, and U261, the ALJ he completely ignores the fact that Tom Hilbert testified extensively. It's quoted in our brief that he went to the site and talked to Jarvis and did warn them.
Into the ALJ's credibility findings here. The ALJ makes a lot of credibility findings, and I think maybe he should have used an adjective. There wasn't credible evidence of warning.
Judge, I don't think you can use credibility as a rug that you sweep under, you know, failure to consider evidence. He never, and I'm talking about the ALJ, not you, Your Honor, he never considers Hilbert's testimony. It is not mentioned anywhere in that decision. And Hilbert's testimony is significant. He says, I went out there and told him, you got to do a better job of doing cover because we got a siting application pending, and if there's a cover violation, we got problems. Expansion of the landfill may be denied. That is not mentioned anywhere in the ALJ's decision. The testimony is extensive. It's at page U261. You can't ignore it. He ignored it.
I guess, you know, from your point of view, it's ignoring, but we have a lot of cases in which we've said we aren't going to sit here and tell the ALJs that they've got to mention every last thing in the record. They can write their opinions, they can indicate their credibility determinations, and they highlight what they think is relevant.
I agree with you.
Because the burden of proof is to see, is there evidence that supports the ALJ, not is there evidence that might defeat the ALJ's
opinion. I don't disagree with you, Judge, but when you look at the four cases I mentioned, Weiss Memorial, what was it the ALJ overlooked that resulted in overturning that decision? A letter, the date on a letter versus the date of an encounter between the employee and the head of the hospital. That's all it took to overturn it, was that detail.
That kind of powerful evidence, and we will say that as well. You know, if there's something that would flatly contradict, we at least want to know why the ALJ didn't agree with it. You're talking about somebody's testimony.
I'm talking same thing in Sears. There was another example of an employee who was fired for the same problem without being involved in the union. In this case, the warning, the ALJ's point is that the failure to warn Jarvis up front about the need, the importance of cover, figures very prominently in the ALJ's decision. He cannot overlook the fact that there's evidence the man was specifically warned. You can't just disregard that.
If you believe Hilbert's testimony.
That's true, but he doesn't consider it and reject it. That's my point. Give me a fair shake is all I'm saying. If you're going to reject my evidence, at least consider it. If he wants to consider Hilbert and say, I don't believe him, that's fine. But you still got to consider Hilbert, and that's what he didn't do. Same thing with respect to this issue of ensuring proper cover. You know, the ALJ's opinion says that the only thing about ensuring proper cover that was important with respect to Jarvis is, well, all you got to do is go out there and say, looks good to me, and he's done. That's the full extent of that discussion. But when you look at this record, you know, and I'm not making light of this, when Jeff Jarvis was cross-examined about the responsibility for ensuring adequate cover at the end of every workday, the man had a seizure, and the whole hearing ended right there during cross-examination on that point. I mean, not a critical issue? I'd say it's a pretty critical issue. And the fact is the ALJ does not discuss the extensive cross-examination and admissions made by Jeff Jarvis about his responsibilities for ensuring adequate cover at the end of the day, which forms the basis, one of the bases, for his discharge. Now, how can you ignore that testimony and what happened when he's being cross-examined about it? It's not considered in the context of this case. That's the third point is the seriousness of the violation. You know, the ALJ says this was no big deal. Well, it was. You know, they overlooked the fact that there's a difference between a notice of violation and an administrative citation. The administrative citation that was issued for this is completely different, and that distinction was overlooked by the ALJ. You've got an inspector who is calling the landfill the day after this happens on a state holiday when she should have been probably off to report it, saying it looks intentional, saying we're probably going to refer it to the Attorney General for enforcement action. Do you see any of that testimony mentioned at all in the ALJ's decision? No. He says this was no big deal, this violation. I'm sorry. All I'm saying is, you overturn these decisions when these sorts of details on crucial issues are overlooked and ignored, because that means there has not been a balanced reading of the entire record and the inferences it gives rise to. That's what's unfair about the decision, and that's why we'd ask that you set these decisions aside. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Side, or whoever's coming up next.
Good morning, Your Honor. David Side for the Labor Board. The ultimate issue in this case is whether the board reasonably found that the company had a bargaining obligation with the union. The company has made two arguments as to why it doesn't have that obligation, both of which involve the determinative ballot of employee Jarvis. First, that he was a statutory supervisor under the Act, therefore not eligible to vote. Second, if he was eligible to vote, that is discharge a week before the election, therefore precluded his vote from counting. With respect to the supervisory issue, the only argument that the company raised in its brief to this court was an attack on the legal standard, an assertion that the clarification the board made in its Oakwood case as to what constitutes responsibility to direct, an accountability principle, was, as a matter of law, an improper interpretation and an impermissible interpretation of the Act. Not only does this court's decision in Loperex firmly address that argument, this court doesn't even have to go there in this case, because that argument was never raised to the board.
So you think even if Mr. Vinson is right about Loperex, there's no need to ask the board what it thinks about how that decision applies?
Well, Your Honor, the Loperex decision is entirely consistent with what the board did in Oakwood. It recognized the basic principle that it's acceptable to have an accountability standard, while recognizing that you do have to be careful about distinguishing between accountability and drawing discipline into that. So there's nothing inconsistent with what the court's decision was in Loperex and what the board did in Oakwood. But
what other evidence of supervisory status or lack thereof do you think, getting beyond your waiver argument, I understand that argument, do you think supports the board's decision?
Oh.
What kinds of things show that Mr. Jarvis was not really a supervisor?
Well, beyond as far as the legal standard not being before the court, I would also note that any application, assuming that the board applied the proper standard, any application of that standard to the facts is not before this court, because in the opening brief, the company only made a legal argument. It did not say, accepting that what the board did in Oakwood is okay and its application is acceptable here, here's why, under the facts, we've met that accountability standard. So that also, by not raising it in the opening brief, has been waived before this court. But having said that, to address the question here, the only argument that ever was raised, and was raised before the board, though not before this court, was on the accountability issue. And here, in the representation proceeding, Charles Gelderloos, the co-owner of the landfill, specifically testified that he would not hold Jarvis accountable for the work of others. So that explicitly rejects any argument the company can make that Jarvis would be held accountable.
So I suppose what you have to do is you have to blend that testimony with the fact that it doesn't make any difference if there may have been some other testimony that a rational fact finder might have inferred accountability from, as long as there is evidence that supports the ALJ's position.
That's correct. There is certainly ample evidence to support what the board did here.
When, if at all, during all of this discussions between the company and the union organizers, did it become apparent that three of the five people working at the Phil were supportive of the union?
Your Honor, certainly it was before the election and before Jarvis's.
We just had things people kind of know. How are you going to vote? Right. How am I going to vote? Did the record tell us when it became apparent that the union had majority support?
The record doesn't specifically state, but the company concedes that it had full knowledge that it knew that three of the employees were pro-union supporters, and that certainly provides, as far as the discharge issue, there's certainly no dispute here that there's ample evidence of unlawful motivation. Not only does the company concede knowledge that Jarvis was a union supporter, but it discharges him just 8 days before the election, and then under the circumstances where it knows that two other employees are also union supporters, and that if it discharges anyone right before the election, it certainly is going to make the union's ability to win the election more difficult.
But the record doesn't have some specific date in time relating to when the election actually happens.
Not a specific date. We certainly know that at the original representation proceeding that Mr. Jarvis gave testimony that was contrary to the company's position, and so certainly as of that point, if not earlier.
I ask that because this is an unusual case when you talk about a bargaining unit that's going to have five people in it. It's a little harder to gauge sentiment in a 450-person workforce.
Right, but it is significant that the company, as far as showing unlawful motivation or evidence that that the union activity and protected conduct was a motivating factor, that the company concedes that it had knowledge, and again, given the timing, how all this went down.
And Mr. Cater was a union supporter as well?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Who had this phantom job offer?
Well, that's correct. And if I could briefly address why the company has not shown by a preponderance of the evidence that it would have discharged Mr. Jarvis absent his protected conduct. The company has tried to make an argument that Mr. Jarvis engaged in this egregious, horrendous conduct on January 13th that left it with no choice but to discharge him. The reason why the company hasn't carried its burden by preponderance of the evidence to show that it would have acted in this manner absent the protected activity, there are really two salient points. First, at the time of Mr. Jarvis's discharge, he is not told anything about work performance, and certainly nothing about January 13th. And then second, there's this whole aspect of the transfer.
So you think if this citation had been, or that the ALJ was entitled to infer that if this citation had really been the reason, the failure to ensure that there was cover on that day when he was fired, they would have said, you're doing a bad job, we're firing you.
That's correct, Your Honor. And there's certainly ample case law when a person is told one thing and then the company tries to rely on something else that really undermines any employer argument. And then we have the issue of the transfer, because the company insisted at the hearing, and then even in its opening brief, that if only this other pro-union employee, employee Cater, had accepted a transfer to an affiliated company, it would have been more than happy to keep Jarvis on the job. That is entirely inconsistent with any attempt to argue before the board and now before this court that Mr. Jarvis had engaged in this horrible, egregious act on January 13th that left it with no choice but to discharge him. And in fact, at the hearing, there was even testimony that the company would have considered him suitable for future employment. Again, an argument that's wholly inconsistent with any claim that Jarvis had been fired for poor work performance. And I would further note that in the company's reply brief, it's rather telling. It makes no attempt at all to deal with this whole transfer issue. It just simply ignores it, because there simply is no good answer for it as far as trying to show by a preponderance of the evidence that it would have taken the same action absent Jarvis's protected conduct. And unless this court has any further questions, it would simply ask that it enforce the board's order.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Seid.
Turn it over to my union intervening colleague.
Mr. Diemer.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. My name is Brian Diemer, and I represent the intervener in this case, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150. At the outset, we note that we would join in all the arguments made by the NLRB in this case, and we ask that the orders of the NLRB be affirmed in their entirety.
So, Mr. Diemer, following up on Judge Evans' question, I take it originally the company figures out that at least Mr. Jarvis is pro-union because he's the one who originally contacted the union?
Correct.
And but what about the other two?
I think that knowledge, again, the company concedes knowledge, but as a factual matter, I think that knowledge, and this is set forth in the ALJ's decision, was established at the pre-election our case hearings. This is the hearing to determine whether Jarvis is in fact a supervisor. And at that hearing, Jarvis, Grubick, and Cater testified in support of the union's position. Also at that hearing, those three employees sat next to the union organizer and next to the union attorney in that case.
And the date of that hearing is what?
There were two hearings, Your Honor. The first hearing was in September of 06. The regional director issued a decision in that case, and then 3 days after that decision was issued, the board issued its decision in Oakwood. So the employer had filed a motion for reconsideration and was recessed. So there was a subsequent hearing later in the fall of 06, and then the union election, of course, in February of 07.
So at a minimum, a couple of months before.
Correct.
All of these events of January 13th and so forth.
And I think that in response to Your Honor's question, different than a bargaining unit of, say, 400, oftentimes it's much easier to read the tea leaves in smaller bargaining units just because of the scuttlebutt and the discussions that
you
are going on.
You don't need tea leaves for a five-person. I mean, these people have lunch together. I mean,
correct.
And talk. It would be rather unusual to not have say, are you going to vote for the union or not?
Correct. And of course, the board applies often, although it wasn't in this case the small plant doctrine where knowledge is inferred by the small size of the bargaining unit. Your Honors, I want to address issues related to the ALJ's finding on the 8A3 and 8A4 violation, and in particular respond to counsel's observation that the ALJ ignored certain evidence, particularly this warning to Jarvis. Again, we believe that the January 13th incident had nothing to do with Jarvis's discharge. And in fact, the ALJ held that the January 13th incident was immaterial to the issues in the case. Upon that finding, I think issues related to warnings and the like become irrelevant to the analysis. And we believe that substantial evidence supports the ALJ's finding that the January 13th incident was immaterial, and there are several reasons for that. As counsel for the board stated, at the time of his discharge, or a permanent layoff, as they initially called it, operations Evan Boskell did not mention the January 13th incident. In fact, he told Jarvis he was being laid off because the landfill was overstaffed. At trial,
between a discharge and a permanent layoff.
Well, I think, Your Honor, as a practical matter, they explained to Jarvis that he was being permanently laid off with no expectation of recall. So as a practical matter, I think the two are probably synonymous. And in fact, throughout the case, the ALJ and the parties have sort of been using those terms interchangeably. But in any event, and more importantly, at trial, Bosco was given an opportunity to explain his decision. Counsel for the employer asked him, Bosco, directly to explain why he selected Jarvis for permanent layoff. Bosco explained that when he arrived at the landfill on January 16th, he alone promptly determined that the landfill was overstaffed. He then evaluated the workforce and determined that he determined that employees Mike Grubick and Matt Cater were the ones that he wanted to work with going forward. At no time in his trial testimony did Bosco, the lone decision maker, alleged lone decision maker, say that he based any part of his decision on the January 13th incident. In fact, as I think was noted earlier, the ALJ found him to be an incredible witness. But in any event, he was given the opportunity to explain his decision. That would have been the time that he would have explained, if in fact he based the decision on the January 13th incident, one would have expected him to state it then. He testified that it was a hard decision. He testified that it was nothing personal. And most importantly, he testified that he did not find Jarvis unsuitable for future employment. Again, hardly the testimony one would expect from a supervisor laying off an employee for engaging in what the employer now contends was blatant, intentional, and egregious misconduct designed to threaten the future viability of the landfill. The final point I want to make is that in its response brief, reply brief, the employer argues that Bosco didn't raise the January 13th incident in his meeting with Jarvis because he was trying to avoid a confrontational discussion. There's no support for that cite in the brief, and there's no support for that cite in the record. Bosco was given an opportunity to explain his decision, and at no time in the trial did he explain that he limited his comments on January 24th, the day he fired Bosco, because he was trying to avoid confrontation. We believe substantial evidence supports the decisions of the ALJ and the regional director, and we ask that the orders of the NLRB be affirmed. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Vincent?
Four brief points. First, the suggestion that Mr. Boskell did not cite the January 13th incident as one of the grounds for his discharge of Mr. Jarvis is completely insupportable. At page U329 to 330 of this record, Mr. Boskell says specifically that it was because of problems with Jarvis's judgment on the cover issue on January 13th. That's exactly his words.
Does he ever say that he told Mr. Jarvis this?
No, he does not. I agree with that. But the fact is,
Mr. Jarvis has never told. Why wouldn't you tell an employee that you're being fired for unsatisfactory performance? That's the strongest reason an employer can give.
I'm not sure that an absence of evidence judge necessarily is something that the board can rely on to meet its burden.
Well, the board is saying that when you say it's overstaffing and your real reason, as perhaps Mr. Boskell may have said, is something else, that can give rise to an inference that the real reason is
I do want to go to that overstaffing issue, because that's another point that I think is completely unsupported by the other side. It's another point that the LJ completely overlooked. There was significant evidence introduced that Winnebago Reclamation, a sister landfill that Evan Boskell ran, operated with three times as much garbage and a staff of six. And this place had only operated, this had a third as much garbage and had five people.
So I take it that Boskell was just superfluous when he was working at Winnebago?
No. He was the sixth person.
He's given it up now when he moves over to...
No, they had to find somebody else for him at Winnebago Reclamation. Well, that's not part of the record, but the point is, if you need six people at Winnebago Reclamation to handle three times as much garbage, you don't need six people at Rochelle to handle one-third that amount of garbage. So
I think it's just a suspicious moment for that insight to dawn, since I guess the volume of garbage was going up at New Rochelle, not down, and it was cyclical.
It was within the range. I don't disagree with that. But from a staffing standpoint, it comes back to my point of, if you're going to ding me on the fact of what's believable and credibility, at least consider all the evidence. You can't say that the entire record was considered and the inferences drawn from it if you don't consider all of these key points of evidence, which none of those gaps have really been filled here by the boards of the union's arguments.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We will take the case under advisement. Thanks.